Welcome to Faye's Knowledge. If you're interested in learning about business, marketing, and personal development, this podcast is just for you. And I say it's just for you because in order to fail, we have to be willing to try. And once you try to do things for yourself, now you're learning and gaining the experience for yourself, which turns into knowledge. So this is the right podcast for you if you're looking for business, marketing, and personal development information, because now you have a chance to learn from others that have been through what you're currently going through or currently having experience, and this is the place for you to grow and develop to help become the best version of yourself. Subscribe to this podcast, and if you really enjoyed towards the end, leave a comment on your biggest takeaway from this specific episode, so that way we can deliver more content, more audio, more videos that can not only help you in your journey but can help propel you. And by propel, I'm actually saying that can help grow and push you forward in your journey. Again, welcome to Failure's Knowledge. Enjoy this episode, and please don't forget to subscribe and wait towards the end and leave a comment about this specific video, your biggest takeaway from this.
Learn your resilience through adversity, through being an athlete. Start small, and then they start recognizing it, and they're like, oh, I should have listened to you in the beginning. When you go from being one to not being one anymore, it's like, who am I? I'm an advice giver. I like to listen. I'd much rather listen than speak. Take responsibility for whatever happened.
What does failure is knowledge mean to you?
To welcome failure is to welcome knowledge.
Liana, thanks again for coming on to the Failure's Knowledge Podcast. I just got one question for you.
Ready?
Why TBAC Corporate?
Why am I in it, or why go for it?
Both.
Why go for it? I'll start with that. We are, like I told you earlier when we were emailing, I am in the middle of pivoting TBAC Corporate. And what we were doing before was targeting employers and employees. And what we're realizing is that employers don't actually seem to be able to create such big change at one time for their employees. So I thought, what better than to just target the employer themselves and provide more leadership training? So why TBAC Corporate is basically leadership training now at this point. So what we're doing is trying to create a gold standard for transformational leadership. So I'll get into it later why that, but why am I in it? As we talked about it briefly, my history kind of going into sports psychology and how I wanted to work with coaches in the beginning. And now I'm turning employers into coaches and employees into corporate athletes at the end of the day. So why I'm in it is to create better leadership, to make a healthier workplace. Corporate can be pretty daunting these days and pretty draining and full of burnout and fatigue. So I want to change the status quo, however we would say it. But yeah, I want to make a better, healthier workplace, and I want people just more excited to go to work.
As I was doing research upon you, and then I remember the conversations that we had previously, because we've been talking a lot, and as I was doing research, everything started to make sense. You said a key word that's so vital to your entrepreneurship journey, or anybody that's a leader or is starting their own business, is pivoting. Mm-hmm. Not pivoting. If you're not changing your direction in the business that you're doing, then eventually I don't think you're in the right business. Because for instance, for me, in the last couple of months, I didn't have to change my business model so many different times. At first it was building culture through podcasts. And then like when I go and pitch it and share with other people, that was like you can get the reaction. And somebody asked me like, so what do you do? I'm like, well, we help leaders build culture through podcasting. And they just looked at me.
Blank.
Looked at me. I'm like, hello. I thought that was it. Oh, I'm like, now I got to pivot again. Now yeah. I got to change everything to match the current language. Oh, yeah. But you're resilient. You are figuring it out that if one thing isn't working, that doesn't mean it's the end of the day. It doesn't mean that you have to go out of business. What it does mean is that you have to change and adapt. My question is, how did you become so resilient to be able to adapt to the changes?
I would say, and I know if not most, all athletes would agree with me, is you learn your resilience through adversity, through being an athlete. And that's probably one of the hardest jobs, even if you're not Division I. Being a club athlete, doing varsity in high school, playing in college, it's a job. D2, D3, they're jobs. D1, it's a job. And so I think you learn at a young age when you start not making teams that you want to make and you're like, oh, I wish I had that. Like, I wish I was on there with my friend and I made the team just below. And you're like, dang, like, what am I missing? You build resilience through adversity. And so I think as a kid, soccer was my sport. I tried other sports and that hand-eye coordination missed me completely other than with my feet. So soccer was it for me. And I played in college, I played abroad, and I was told no multiple times. I mean, even the recruiting process, you have to be so extremely resilient because maybe they were looking at you one day and they just got a striker the next and they say, we don't need you anymore. And it's like, I have to pivot, right? And so, especially through the stuff that happened to me early on, in, I don't know, later on in my soccer career, where again, you have to learn how to pivot. So resilience, I think, was built not even just from the athlete side, though. I think that's a massive contribution as to why I'm so resilient. But as a kid, too, I went through adversity as a kid through school. Academics was not my best friend. I hated standardized testing. I hated being in school, to be quite honest with you. Math was my ultimate enemy. I could not do it. And so I think learning how to function independently is one thing, but learning how to thrive through a harsh element is a completely other thing. And I kind of curated both through childhood and then through soccer. So I would say resilience was built from a lot of different factors in my life, but sport plays a huge role.
As you was explaining it, I literally thought about when I was playing high school football, and then my senior year, I ended up tearing my ACL. So I knew, like, going into my senior year, I wasn't going to play college football because I was only 180 pounds, 5'7". I'm like, yeah, I'm not about to go through this again. but the fact that I had went to a football camp this past weekend, I was just there to, like, volunteer and just be around it. Yeah. I'm seeing these coaches coach the players that was there, and I see the passion that they have. I develop a new level of awareness. I was like, wait, it's different from being a player. You don't see the impact because you have to do the playing and and the practicing and the focusing and the training and then watching film and so on and so forth. Whereas when you're the coach or the mentor, you start to see that you're guiding these players to become better. Yeah. And I'm just watching. I'm like surprised because I forgot the love of the game. I forgot the love of the game. And as I was doing research on you, your focus is really putting your client first because you was an athlete. So you understand the trials and tribulations that athletes go through. So when it comes to mental health, how do you incorporate the mentorship around everything that an athlete goes through?
I think while working with athletes, when I was doing sports psychology at Boston University, like I said in my bio, I'm sure like you've read it at TBAC, it's I put my clients are the expert in their story, and I am just here to guide and to help them seek what they're looking for. And that could be closure, that could be an answer, which most people already kind of have, and they just don't know how to get it out of themselves, right? And so I think a lot of it is observation and listening. I usually, even with my clinical clients, I think that they know what they need to work on, but it's that stubbornness level. Same with athletes. Athletes are stubborn. They're probably one of the more stubborn population out there when it comes to, they can bounce back from mistakes. Most can, right? But it's that stubbornness to listen to authority and take what they're saying and implement it and apply it on the field, on the pitch, wherever. Clinically, it's the same thing, but out there, there's no game. That game is real life. Right. And so as a mentor, I am sitting, listening, and I'm showing up a mirror. I'm like, well, this is what you're telling me. And then they tell me that's not what I said, but that is exactly what you did. Right. And so I think a lot of it is I'm going to challenge them. I am a straight shooter as a therapist, as a person. I don't change in that dynamic. So I think when I'm mentoring, when I'm counseling, when I'm coaching or consulting, what you see is what you get with me. And I think I like that about myself. I think it's nice to be able to portray, like, this is what you're getting. This is how I implement and consult with people. And we're going to get you there somehow. It's not going to be quickly. Most of the time, these things don't happen quickly. But if they're patient with themselves and they're patient with me, usually we can get to where they need to go.
And I definitely agree because it starts with understanding where the other person is coming from. I'm not in the mental health space, but I talk to a lot of people and, you know, you might as well say.
You consult too. You're a mini therapist.
Yeah. An unpaid therapist. Yeah.
Life coach.
A life coach. I don't know about a life coach. I thought about that. I don't know. But earlier you mentioned how you had to pivot And you also explained the importance of, well, you have to pivot into leadership because you recognize certain messages, certain things that you were saying about your marketing or how you help people wasn't connecting. And so when you start switching your language again to where people understand everything that you're doing, everything that you explain is something that you have to guide yourself through. Yeah. You had to build that resilience. You had to overcome obstacles. You had to learn how to pivot. And so when a client comes to you, I'm listening to what you're saying, but when a client comes to you, you let them be the expertise and you're just the guidance of their journey. Like, hey, well, I get it. You've been through a lot, but just because you've been through a lot doesn't mean it's the end of the world.
100%. Mm-hmm.
How are you able to see the transformation when people come into your clinic, when people come into TBAC Corporate? How are you able to see that transformation from them coming for the first meeting to the second meeting to the second appointment and so on and so forth?
Oh my God, I could give you countless stories of like where I've seen change and transformation. And it's small. It starts small and then they start recognizing it. And they're like, oh, like I should have listened to you in the beginning. You were right. But I see it in so many different ways. I have this one client. She's in her like middle teens. She's in sophomore year of high school. When I saw her, she was starting freshman and her voice was, you couldn't even hear it. You could not hear her talk. She was so anxious. And now, 2 years later, about, she sits in my office and she sits like she's comfortable, for one. Usually when they're comfortable, they're laying down or they're holding a pillow or something. And she is actively telling me things without me having to grab it out of her. Comfort and rapport. And I think that's the biggest thing that I've been trying to do with corporate now, because as we've pivoted, which we continue to pivot, and I don't think this will be our last pivot by any means, as you know, right? And I think building rapport is where the bread and butter begins, right? It's like they have to know me to trust me. They're not going to trust a stranger, but I want them to build that with me. So building that before even pitching anything, that's the hard part in business, right? It's like, you have to trust me. You have to know that I know what I'm talking about. So how are we doing that now? Is we're creating networking events through corporate so I can get to meet these people without selling them anything. Because let's be honest, I'm not a salesperson. I didn't come into this with an MBA. It was never my dream to sell anything. It was to provide services. I'm a service giver at heart, right? So it's like combining that and adding that business element. Well, I'm going to use psychology and it's my best friend right now. So how do I pitch something? It's emotional. All sales are emotional. Getting better at your craft is emotional. And that's what I've been working on now and trying to see transformation there is what I want to start seeing with corporate. But through clients, it's small. I think through leaders, they get to apply it to the masses. And that could be huge. Huge, huge changes. And people could stay longer at their jobs. Burnout's not as prevalent. So I think in terms of change, it looks different for everybody, but I really want to start seeing it in the leaders that we work with.
Wow. You can definitely hear the transformation because you have to start with yourself. When I recognize that I have to pivot my business model again and I have to change and update it and go to different places, go to different meetings and continue to pitch myself, like you mentioned, like you, I'm not a great salesman. I'm horrible at selling. However, when I start to understand that selling is just communication, if you communicate with people and you lower the barrier, then they will, oh, I feel seen, heard, and trusted.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's understanding that everything that you're doing, you're selling yourself.
Completely.
Transitioning from an athlete to an entrepreneur, how was that transitioning phase?
Hard. It's hard. I feel like, again, I think most athletes can relate, or anyone in a physically labor intensive job, right? Like firefighters. We were working with firefighters too. When you go from being one to not being one anymore, it's like, who am I? Like, I was a sports girl through and through, like tomboy to the top of the level. Like, I had to pivot myself in learning how to be this new me that wasn't a soccer player. I'll say it happily now. I'm retired. I'll put my boots on every once in a while, but I don't play competitively anymore. I miss it, but I think my passion has transitioned now into creating that change for other corporate athletes. And so it's not an easy transition. The space was kind of created for me by my boss, which I'm super appreciative and thankful and grateful towards her for. But it's still change. And whether it's good change or it's bad change, change is still hard. So I think that transition into being an athlete, that's all my body knew, and my body could perform when I needed it to now you get older, you need your mind to start working like your body worked, right? Now I'm using way more of my mind than I used when I was playing soccer because it was natural. This stuff is not natural. So I have to learn it, and I have to learn it from other people, and they have to learn it. So it's like I'm trying to be a sponge is what I'm learning, is that you never stop being a sponge. Growth is always happening around you. So that's what I'm in my educational era. I'm absorbing.
I get told a lot that I'm like a sponge because I'm always asking questions. I get to a point where I'm just asking a whole bunch of questions. And and I give you a prime example. This past weekend, the football program I was telling you about, there was two brothers there. One was 28, other was 26. And you can tell they brothers, but they're the same, but they're the opposite. Like one has a strength and one has a weakness, but they are very intelligent.
Yeah.
And as I'm watching them coaching, like they're, you can tell what they're good at, what they're not good at. And they like embrace what they're good at for sure. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so as I'm talking to them, I'm really learning. I'm really just, hey man, like when it comes to coaching, because I've been out of football for a long time. So it's just like, well, I ain't been a player. I've been doing business. And you know, that's a whole different perspective and mindset that you have to have. Yep. So I'm asking them questions. I'm like, man, so like, are y'all able to see the transformation in y'all mentees or the players that y'all coaching? Are y'all able to see, like, if you do this one thing and you do it, you see the transformation, like you see how your body's moving? They say, yeah. And they got to talk and got to explain them. And it was like, well, then I asked, because they focus a lot about psychology. Yeah. And I'm like, well, in my mind, if you study psychology, you pay attention to a lot of people. You pay attention to a lot of body movements, how they communicate, talking, so on and so forth. So as I was like, so y'all study psychology a lot. So what do y'all think about us, about me, by this being our first interaction? And I was like, well, to keep it in simplest terms, I was like, well, you asked a lot of questions. I don't think we know a lot about you. And I'm like, man, forgot all about that. You know what I mean? I forgot all about to share. I thought I was, but I wasn't sharing as much as they were sharing. Cause I'm like, yeah, okay. Then they talking and they literally like conversing off each other. I'm just listening. Yeah. I'm just, yup, for real? Nah, man. Yeah, right. It's important to have mentors. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I shared that is because they might think they don't know anything about me. I was sharing little bits of parts about it, but there's a time and a place to show your expertise. Mm-hmm. Before you show your expertise, you have to be around mentors that understand what you are trying to do. And you brought up something about a mentor. How was it being a mentee to understand, well, I'm getting myself better. I'm a sponge. I have to learn this information because in business, you got to learn sales. You got to learn marketing. You got to learn team development. You got to learn operations. You got to learn follow-up. You got to learn all these different things. As a mentee, why is it important to learn from a mentor who has done what you would like to do?
Oh, it's like firsthand experience being copy and pasted into your life. It's like they're giving you a handbook. It's like you're going to build something from IKEA and you could not do that without the manual. You know what I mean? So it's like having mine, Dr. Diaz, she's my boss. She's been my clinical supervisor. I adore her. She is someone who mentally so strong. She is so creative and so knowledgeable. And those are traits that I want. And those are ones that I have, but you have to continue to feed them, right? And I think by feeding them is by watching people who do the same thing. And of course, I'm not going to be a Dr. Diaz. I'll never be Dr. Diaz. I'm just going to be me. And she's never going to be me, right? So it's like, I get to add my own unique flavor to stuff that she's doing, because I can see it. Me and her, we lead a little bit differently. And that's fine, but she does a wonderful job at what she does. And it's those pieces that I see where people are listening to her and validating her and so supportive and loving of her like me, that it's like, I want people to do the same for me when they work under me. So how does she do that? Like, what is that secret sauce of, you're not micromanaging people, you are being so supportive and putting your employees first in a job where it's hard to put your employees first in the mental health field, because you have one employee who's caring for 30 plus clients and you want to put them first, but she puts the employee first for the reason, because if they're not healthy, 30 people don't get help, right? And so in that clinical setting, she is boss woman. She, I will say yes to whatever she needs me to do, but I want someone to do that for me eventually. So it's learning how she does that and then adding my own flavor to the mix and kind of seeing what I can create. But to be a mentee of hers, I wouldn't change anything. I think she has given me so many opportunities and autonomy, which a lot of people struggle to give people who are doing things for the first time because they don't trust them. And so to be trusted like this, I've never had that in my life before. So I'm eating it up. I'm just going to keep eating it up until I can't anymore.
Well, and you're a sponge, and you mentioned, because as I was doing research upon you, you kind of described it, but the three ways to improve employee wellness. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that post that you posted?
Oh, Beatrice, our social media coordinator, let me shout out to her real quick, because she is a USF student doing wonders on our back end. She's been curating all of these tips, tricks, and everything. So I bet I could find the Instagram post where she did it. But she has been wonderful. Refresh my memory. What did she say? Because we have a lot out there.
Understood. Three ways to improve employee wellness. Oh, and shout out to your social media team as well. They do a phenomenal job. Number one is 15-minute weekly check-ins. Number two is set communication boundaries. Number three, recognize wins. I can't read my handwriting. Recognize wins after. I think that's after.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that check-in. So helpful. I think we could give more information on each one and talk about each one forever. I think people don't do check-ins. The funny thing about emotions is everyone has them. Not everyone's cool with them, right? And so to wake up, I have a feelings wheel here. Hold on, I'm going to grab it. These are just some of the emotions that we may feel, right? And we have an inner circle, which is the regular ones, right? Like happy, sad, angry, scared, regular emotions that everyone kind of has the vocabulary for. But as you go into the second circle and the third circle, we have words that we never use. Like if we're in the happy side, we're not going to say, I'm just feeling so enthusiastic today. No one uses that, right? If we're looking in the fear side, not many people are talking about embarrassment because they're embarrassed. Why would they? Right? So no one's using the word. What about sad? No one's saying I'm feeling inferior or insignificant. They just feel sad, right? And so when people do check-ins with themselves, they actually finally will figure out, using tools like this, how do I actually feel? Because behavior is born from thought and feeling. So those check-ins in the morning, those check-ins midday, those check-ins at night, game changing. Because if you can actually tell me how you feel, and it's not just the inner circle, happy, sad, mad, then I'll tell you, you're doing a much better job than a lot of other people.
And I think this is where your mentor gave you the autonomy, because you're able to acknowledge everything that she was doing, even though that she probably wasn't explaining everything.
Right.
But the fact that you was able to observe and see how she moved, how she communicate, why she talked to some different people a certain type of way, and then how they respond. When you just showed me that, you made me think of that movie. I think it's Inside Out.
Inside Out. We love that movie as a counselor.
Really? Why so?
Oh my God. I think it's one of the first animated movies that give a distinct color to emotion, because a lot of people will think in color more so than in words, right? And so we're seeing joy and we're seeing sadness as blue, right? And anxiety is orange, and there's a whole bunch of stuff to it. To be able to connect with an emotion, huge, because trauma is a thing. Complex trauma is a big thing, right? And a lot of the times it stunts our ability to connect emotionally to ourselves. So we'll just say, I don't know how I feel. Numb. Right? I would say then that I would feel numb. I'm sure you could tell me many people that use the word fine, right? But what does fine mean? Fine's not an emotion. I hate that F word. I tell all my clients, delete that F word from your vocabulary. You don't need it anymore because you need good vocabulary to describe what's going on. And so my boss, she's a wonderful communicator and she's transparent, which I think a lot of leaders miss these days. They like to make snap decisions, tell everybody about the change, but doesn't give people enough time to equalize out and kind of wrap their mind around what's happening. They're just, okay, well, I guess that's changing and that's it. She gives notice and she explains it and she takes her time and she's patient about it, right? So it's like, these are qualities of a wonderful leader. And that is kind of what we're building corporate off of, is this gold standard of quality leadership where they communicate, they understand, and they don't already come to you. The leaders have a populated answer in their mind already, assuming what their employee is coming to them about, instead of just hearing them.
Wow. So at TBAC Corporate, mm-hmm. you put the client first because they give them some type of autonomy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So instead of you pulling the information out, eventually, once they get comfortable with what the process is and how they can express their emotions, you create a comfortable, safe environment.
Have to. They need to feel wrapped in this beautifully protective bubble to be like, okay, Liana, I'm actually really upset that this happened. Instead of saying, no, it's fine, I figured it out. Tell me how you figured it out. How did this happen? Same with leaders, right? And leaders are hard because they, in their mind, there's ego attached to leadership, right? And pride and not wanting to make a mistake and perfectionistic tendencies. That's hard to penetrate through, right? And so here I am coming as a third party saying, all right, well, we could work on this. Immediately, they're going to get defensive because I'm being critical and they don't want to hear criticism. They want to hear praise, right? And so that's where that good old compliment sandwich comes into play, right? It's like, hey, you're doing a great job. Maybe if we tighten this up, then you could perform way better over here, right? Like that just sounds better. And my boss does a wonderful compliment sandwich when she's giving feedback. And I'm more receptive to it. I'm more open-minded because everyone takes feedback differently, right? I'm sure as an athlete, you probably had coaches yelling at you left and right, and maybe getting yelled at isn't what you need, but getting yelled at from other people is exactly what they need, right? So it's like, what is your fuel? You have to know someone's fuel to light their fire and finding what's going to help them tick, what's going to help them learn and absorb more.
My wife always asks me how I'm feeling, and I'm like, well, what does feeling have to do with me doing something like I think that's the wrong question because it's like, well, I just did something really exciting. I don't know if it's how I feel about it, but, you know, I guess so. So I'm learning. She was like, well, because everything that you're doing has some type of feeling behind it and you have to express how you're feeling. And I was like, well, okay, well, I'm learning. So there's a process behind everything and I'm a sponge. I'm always asking questions. And I recently discovered the importance of really being a leader.
Yeah.
When in high school, I was a football captain. But of course, like when you're young and you have that position of leader, I don't look at myself like that. Like I didn't look at myself as a leader. I'm like, well, thanks, but I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing just to, you know, just to be better. I always want to get better. Yeah. Then as you grow up and go through the ages and get more mature, you start to understand leadership is really important.
Oh, yeah.
You have to lead by example. And if you're not leading by example, you're not giving your people space, time and effort to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to figure out the business that you're in, which is the helping, you're in the business of helping people because you always provide a service. Was it hard for you to say every time I go out, I'm going to help somebody? Or is it just like you're always on to help somebody?
I don't think there's an off button. I'll be honest. I feel like once I found this profession, there's no other dream job. Like, could I be an astronaut? Yeah. But would I rather do what I'm doing? Yeah. Because I know that I can make a difference. And like I said, helping and acts of service, that's my love language. So I think it's cool to match your love language to your job, right? Because then it's not work anymore, right? I'm doing something where I love to help. I'm an advice giver. I like to listen. I'd much rather listen than speak, right? Although I love a podcast, I'm asking other people questions, same as you, right? So it's like, I love to ask, I love to listen, I love to shut up and just observe, right? And so, but that's my love language. And so for me, I could see eight people a day and be like, okay, you know what? That was a long day, but that was eight people that we got through and we made a difference for. So for me, that was good. I'm not burnt out. I'm not fatigued because I like what I'm doing. But I think a lot of people are doing things because they feel like they have to, or doing jobs where it's like financially they need it. So they're not, but mentally they're not in it. It's going to clash, right? And so that's why I think it's so important when they tell us as kids, like, pick something that you love. Right. But then a kid goes and chooses an art major and the parents are like, well, you're never going to make any money from that. You're immediately shot down. Right. As you're growing, you don't have that resilience yet in that moment to fight like, yeah, I want to be an art major. I can do it. Kids change to an MBA. Right. And then they never use that degree. So it's like you have to find what makes you tick in order to kind of do it well, I think.
So you said NBA twice, and I think you're taking a shot at me because I'm not getting my NBA right now.
I need an NBA. I was talking about it the other day. I said, you know what I don't have is something that I actually need is my NBA, right? And my sister's looking into her NBA, and it's stuff she wants to do. So beautiful. Do it, right? I think the moral of the story is we start getting into things that maybe we didn't think was an option when we were younger, and we're learning the ropes again. So that's why we need the mentors, because we need the handbook. Becoming a counselor, I feel like I didn't really get that handbook until I graduated from graduate school, right? And then I figured out, okay, it's another 2 years of hours to get until I'm actually a licensed counselor. So I've just done school, might as well have been a doctor, and I'm doing it for 4 years until I'm even licensed. But I didn't know that. And so you're finding stuff out along the way. And you have to be a sponge in those years to kind of understand, like, I'm going to have to jump through many hoops to get to where I need to go. And MBA is another hoop that I may choose not to go through because I'm stubborn and want to learn it a different way. But it's an option and it's something to consider.
I definitely agree. You just explained the importance of pivoting. Like, you never know. Like, I started, when I was doing research on you, you got something in exercise science.
I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you have a degree in that too, right?
I do. So okay. At Appalachian, I majored in psychology and public health, and I double minored in sports performance and coaching and exercise science.
Okay. I was going to say, because when I first went to college, I went to college around like 18 mm-hmm. before I joined the Marine Corps.
Right.
And I was going for kinesiology mm-hmm. because I had told my ACL. I'm like, well, I think this is what I'm going to be. And my physical therapist, he was like, well, he get to help a lot of people. I'm like, so do you enjoy this? He was like, yeah. He was like, every time somebody come in, I get to help them. Yeah. Like, okay, that sounds good. I go to school. Mm-hmm. And it didn't register to me that if you want to be like a physical therapist, a doctor, nurse, well, a physical therapist, mm-hmm. you have to take a lot of science classes.
Science.
School. He didn't tell me that.
Doc, that's what I'm saying, right? So it's like, yeah, I want to be a counselor. You need to do this. I didn't even know half of that until I was already in a program.
Yep.
Right? I was like, I'm not going to back out now. I've already committed to this. Like, I'm not... Social work would have been easier. That would have been less amount of hours to get, but I committed, so I went. But you're so right. Like, you need to know what you're walking into before you get into it.
Yep. And I did not know it. When I found out, I said, this is not for me.
That was the same for me. I thought I was going to be a physical therapist because soccer, I think a lot of athletes will either go down the coaching route or the athletic trainer route or a PT, right? And so I'm like, yeah, physical training, they're like, I could do that. PT is easy for me because of sport. Chemistry, one chemistry class took me out. Nope. Chemistry two took me out even further. And that's when I was like, maybe a science heavy one isn't for me. And that's fine because I'm probably wouldn't have been a great physical therapist, but I'm a bomb counselor.
You got to know your strengths. You got to know your strengths and your weaknesses. Science is definitely my weakness. So what we're going to do now, we're going to go off script. And I want to come to Liana. And I want to come to you and say, hey, Liana, I'm thinking about getting into the mental health space. And I have no experience. I don't know. I don't have no school. What are three tips that you can give somebody that's starting out in this career?
I would say, okay, let's see. One tip, first tip I would give is I would say get to know yourself get to know, because like I even making that connection to a love language just now, I've never iterated it that way, but seeing and hearing it that just now, because I've always thought like, yeah, I'm a helper, I like that, but I think you need to, it needs to match up to the profession. So first tip I would say is get to know yourself. Are you innately a helper? Right? Because you have to be. If someone comes to you, is it a, okay, let me answer this? Or is it, oh, I got you, let's figure it out together. Are you a collaborator? Right? So I'd say tip one, get to know yourself really well. Tip two, along with getting to know yourself in tip one, tip two is know how to take care of yourself. Because if you're going into a helping profession, burnout and fatigue are at your back door every day, right? You are taking care of so many people. And it's not just that my boyfriend broke up with me or I lost this. It's no, someone died, or it's a sexual assault, or it's a theft and a robbery at gunpoint, or it's a school shooting. Like, these are very heavy things. I think third is maybe understand the capacity of what you can hold, right? So all three have to do with yourself. You have to understand who you are as a person. You have to understand how to take care of yourself. And three, you need to know what your tolerance is. Because if you don't know your own boundaries, you will not make it in a helping profession. Firefighting, nursing, doctor, counselor, you won't make it. You need boundaries. If you're answering the phone at 12 a.m., that's not my work hour. That's not my workspace. What am I doing? Granted, I'll answer the phone and I'll text my employee every once in a while past 6 o'clock, but I don't make it a point to break those boundaries. And so you have to have that respect to yourself and your boundaries to even be able to enter a field like this.
Wow, that's well explained. So just to clarify, to know yourself.
Know yourself.
Know how to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And identify the boundaries that you're setting.
Yeah, know your tolerance.
Mm. You're speaking from a true profession. That's what you're speaking from. And yeah. I want to now that you answered that, and you're someone who's interested in getting the mental health field, they should be able to get in the field confidently, minus the schoolwork. You know, the schoolwork is a whole different, it's a whole different other beast.
Look, I actually thrived in graduate school because there were, besides the licensure exam, which was after the fact, after school, I did not take really any standardized tests, right? Other than the GRE to get in, which that's a whole nother story. Hate standardized testing for getting into anything, right? But used that, got into BU, didn't take, minus a few pop-up quizzes here and there. Everything was oral or written, or you're giving a presentation. Me talking to people, I'll thrive. That was my strength. So school was easy. Graduate school, any school before graduate school, disliked, didn't do it, didn't like doing it, didn't have the most fun because I was getting tested all the time in a way that didn't work to my learning capabilities, right? Like, I'm neurodivergent, I'll say it loud and proud. I learned very differently than the neurotypical person does, but you're testing me as one. And so now you're trying to put me in the scale of thinkers where we don't think the same, we don't process information the same, and yet we're taking the same test to get into school. And you could have a really high IQ neurodivergent person not do well in a test, and so they're deemed ineligible. That sucks. And that's why a lot of people don't go to school. They don't do extra school. They don't do higher education because of the grading scales and the stuff to get into these big universities and colleges, right? And that's why a lot of them go into trades, because they're good with their hands and they know how to do it and they know how to operate, but they don't like a GRE. And that's totally fair, right? And so I think to be able to utilize my strengths in a school that even was teaching me what I wanted to learn, I was like, oh, I got this. I can do this. That's easy.
You made me think about, because you said standardized tests, the ACT in high school, mm-hmm. I took it four times. And the high score that I had was an 18. I said, I just need to get in at this point.
Right. I'll take a passing score. Same here. It was like, I took the ACT. Bomb the SAT, and like there was a blackout the night before. Nothing was going in my favor, and I'm still not a good tester, so that wasn't working for me, right? And so, but yet you need these things to get to where you need to go. So I think if we're going back to that resilience piece, I learned a lot through being neurodivergent because back in the early 2000s, there was no 504 or accommodations to help your girl out with extra testing time or a different testing space because people turning their papers made me anxious and I couldn't focus, right? I didn't have these extra accommodations that kids have these days until it was hard. And so you're building resiliency through learning how to function independently. And that in itself made me the independent thinker that I am because I realized asking for help wasn't really an option because they didn't know how to help me. So I had to help myself. So I think that also lends to the mindset now of if someone tells me no, no might as well be a yes. I'm going to figure it out anyways.
So I think you already covered it, but you talked a lot about resilience, pivoting, changing direction, updating, improving, and just growing within, not only as a person, but as a business owner. So I think you covered it, but I'm going to rephrase the question this way. What has been your biggest failure so far? And how do you know it was considered a failure?
Biggest failure? I think going into something new like this, it's hard to deem, I think, for myself a biggest failure. I know I could give you more examples of where people failed me and where I had to figure that out, right? But for me, I have a funny perspective on failure. It's a lesson. That's what I always tell my clients, right? So to me, it's not like this. Are some of these heartbreaking? Yeah, but am I still going to figure it out? Yes, because of that resiliency. So I'd say biggest failure in terms of like corporate growth was knowing our audience. That I would say was a failure in the beginning because we did go towards government entities and we're recognizing that they only have so many funds and only so much care for the people that are working for them that they're willing to spend this amount of money on good programming, right? So it's like big failure was knowing who to trust. That was a big one for us, right? And so we pivot again. And so then we were thinking employers know what their employees need. Naive. No, they don't. They don't always. Right. And so failed again. Now we have to pivot again. And that's how we're in that leader route, because now I'm talking to the person. Right. Like now I'm talking to you. Do you think you're a good leader? Do you think your people listen to you? Do you think you change lives when you walk into a room? Right. That I can talk to and that I can work with. Right. But if I'm talking to you about Jenny in the corner, I don't know. Jenny comes to work and then she goes home. That's all I know about Jenny. Well, then I can't help Jenny through you. I have to help Jenny through Jenny, but I can't get there because there's too many hoops to go through. So I think that big failure piece is just knowing who to talk to in the beginning. But a startup is hard. What startup isn't hard? And especially when you don't have the marketing money to apply to put your name out there, technically, right? So it's like we have to word of mouth it. And so the failures here have been our audience, but I think we finally found a niche that would answer us.
And it's interesting because you talk about, I talk a lot about epiphanies. And even though my podcast or the platform is called Failure is Knowledge, whenever I get asked, what has been your biggest failure? I'm like, to be honest, everything's a lesson. I can't predict the failure. Some people might be like, are you failing on purpose? Why would I fail on purpose? Like, that doesn't even make sense. I was taking a biology class. Mm-hmm. And when I was about to move to Tampa with my wife, mm-hmm. I found some papers. I found test papers. And all of the test papers that I had, like it was like a regular biology class.
Yep.
I took six quizzes and tests. I didn't pass not one of them. I didn't pass. And I'm like, well, first off, you can't predict that. Okay. Like I'm trying to be in class. I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to understand like everything that right. you're doing. But as far as like a biggest failure, well, I done failed a lot. You know what I mean? I done failed a lot and I'm still trying to figure it out. But every failure leads to the next epiphany. The next epiphany is something like, is a thought process that comes across your mind. It's like, wait,
yep.
That makes sense now.
I love an epiphany and I love seeing my clients have it in the room. It's like you see the light bulb go off and you see just their eyes open and they start recognizing when someone connects something, when 1 + 1 starts equaling 2 for them, it's like, you are there. You got it. Let's use it. Use that as momentum to get to the next one and the next one. But I agree. I mean, I think you have to make mistakes in life to learn. If someone is perfect, they're not growing because they have a fixed mindset they believe that this is what I've got. That's all I've got. I can't have any more. That's where I'm going. That's it. Right. Minus, or look at someone with a growth mindset. It's okay. I made a mistake, but I see where I went wrong. I'm going to try again. That I'm going to try again is growth mindset. Or if it's fixed, it's, well, they were going to say no, and I can't do anything about it.
There's a book that you just may remember. It's called Grit. And you read that book before?
I've read pieces of it. I've not read the whole thing, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. Okay. I got recommended that book from a school that I went to go speak to a couple months ago. Yeah. And one of the teachers that was there, because I talk a lot about failure. Yeah. And she was like, there's a book. There's this book and it's called Grit. And it talks about how a lot of people have skill and talent. But the difference between skill and talent is that the talent is born, like it's natural. Right. Whereas if you're developing a skill, that takes time, it takes effort, and it takes consistency. And it also talked about like the growth mindset and the fixed mindset. And I was like, wow, like that's crazy. And just going around different places, just speaking, doing podcasts, talking to a lot of people. What I recognize is that some people are afraid to fail. Some people are afraid to even try to start up a business, start up business. I'm not going to know everything. The biggest thing that I learned from my mentors, I wasn't even trying to learn it, but I learned it. Mm-hmm. Even though they are mentors, even though they've been in business 20, 30, 40 years, a long time, they still have to pivot.
Every time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They do.
When I heard that, I was like, wait, hold on. Y'all got to pivot too? Y'all got to change and do. Oh, okay. I'm in the right path then. I'm on the right path then.
It's like seeing them as a person. They're not a boss. They don't have it all together. My boss has these meetings with us where she's asking us for feedback and how do we think things are going? And she even recognizes maybe I made a mistake here. Then she owns up to it. And it's like, oh, that's great. So I think accountability is another piece here, which is huge, right? To understand where you went wrong, take responsibility for whatever happened, and then getting past it, right? And so I love accountability takers and people that can't take accountability. I'm going to shove the mirror in front of your face and tell you why you need to, right? Because they need to at some point. But when people don't, they can't admit defeat. And there's a lot of people like who struggle or don't want to fail or don't want to make a mistake. But mistakes are where you learn the most. That's the only way that we do learn, right? And so I wish more people... There's this book. I have Grit on my bookshelf. That's funny. There's another one that I have. I think it's from Adam Grant. I can't remember the name. But he talks about people who learn multiple languages. And it's hard to learn one language, but he's talking about polyglots. Like, how do people learn 5+ languages? How do they do it? And it's that fear of practicing in front of people, that embarrassment, right? Like, embarrassment's the number one issue in getting in people's way of growing. And polyglots, they will practice and they don't care how they sound, at least they're practicing. That's what gets them to the next language that they want to learn, is because they're practicing and applying and they're not waiting until they perfect it internally to then try it.
Okay, so say hypothetically speaking, a client come to you and they come to you and you already have the onboarding meeting, y'all talking, y'all getting to like the root of it.
Yeah.
For someone that struggled with taking accountability, how would you advise them to say, hey, well, first off, you have to start with yourself. Every problem that's around you is a problem. But if you're not seeing the problem that you're doing, that you're causing, you're the problem now. How do you talk about the accountability for your clients?
I love calling them out when they're the issue. I give them the same thing that I'll give you, right? I'll draw like a diagram, a circle for them, and it'll be thought, an arrow, emotion, an arrow, behavior, an arrow, right? And like I said earlier, behavior is born from thought and emotion. And so we have to think something, we have to feel something in order for our bodies to do that. And if we're thinking in some selfish way, right? And then that emotion is embarrassment or whatever it is that we don't want to own up to it. The behavior is to not take accountability, right? So you kind of have to show them how these things pay out, right? So a lot of people don't even recognize the thoughts that they have. They may even just recognize the emotion and then behave. And so thought is like, it almost gets skipped. And you have to get them to figure out what they're actually thinking and then understand and challenge them on it and say, well, if that was said to me, I wouldn't be happy.
if that was said to me, that would make me upset, right? And so counselors are basically perspective givers, right? We're going to tell them, hey, you said that, but how do you think they feel? And then we're taking them out of their shoes and putting them into somebody else's shoe. Or my favorite one is, what do you think I'm going to say back to you right now? And then they have to start thinking how I would say what I would say to them. And that changes things for them. So a lot of getting them to take accountability or understand where they went wrong, they don't like it, but they're like, you're good. And that's what I'll get a lot of the times when I start pointing stuff out. And it's like, I know I'm good. You need to start recognizing when you start doing these things so we can start changing behavioral patterns instead of cycling through the same thing all the time. So a lot of it is behavior awareness, recognizing that, emotional awareness, and then intentional application of a coping mechanism.
I like how you mentioned the arrows, like you have thought, behavior, then emotion. Wait, thought, emotion, then behavior. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then people just go from emotion to behavior, emotion to behavior. Mm-hmm. Well, when you do that, you don't recognize why you're doing it. And and when you get them to see something that they've been doing subconsciously, there's a book called The Power of the Subconscious Mind. When they do something subconscious, they don't understand why they're doing it. But then when you bring it back to reality, it's like, well, this is what you're doing. Then why do you do that?
Yeah. I'll give a quick example. This is what I tell a lot of people, and I even work with other counselors and I tell them the same thing. Imagine you're in this building and it's like a high rise in New York. Like when you're at the penthouse, you can see everything. But in this sky rise right now, we're on the first floor, especially if it's my issue, right? If something just happened to me, I'm on the first floor of a very busy first floor where I can't even see the exit signs, right? So I've got a lot of chatter in my head. I can't see a way out. So what am I going to do? Ask somebody. Hopefully that's not part of the problem. Can they help me out? Give me advice, right? Maybe I'll ask a friend. The friend automatically has got higher than third floor views. They could be penthouse view. They could see everything. They could be perspective givers because they're not part of the problem. But if even as a therapist, I can't always solve all my issues when I'm on the first floor because I can't see an exit because I'm still surrounded by clutter. And so I need to go outside of myself, find a penthouse viewer, ask them, what do they think? And then I could go to another penthouse viewer because everyone's perspective is different. But I will never be penthouse view on my issue. I'll maybe make it to the 10th floor and be like, yeah, okay, I've learned from it. I'm better. I might make that same mistake, though, in a different flavor. And now I'm back to one, right? And so you need a penthouse viewer, which could be a therapist, which could be a mentor, which could be someone you value and respect their opinion of. But you need someone outside of a situation to help pull you out.
When we met at the Temple Business Expo, I mentioned that every therapist needs a therapist. Mm-hmm. Every therapist needs a therapist because when they go and be a therapist to others, they have to understand the process.
Yes. Oh, yeah. A dentist needs a dentist. A doctor needs a doctor. Yeah. If I had to therapize, which I have great self-regulation, right? And I have wonderful emotional awareness. I have these skills. But it's sometimes I get wrapped in my feelings too. And sometimes I'm so angry, I can't get to that emotional piece where I'm just angry and I can't actually figure out that I'm, I don't know, offended. Maybe I felt disrespected, but I can't get there because all I can say is I'm angry, right? And so there's always so much more emotion. It's like an iceberg, right? The finger's at the top. I've got 30 more emotions underneath it, but I can only portray it as angry because a lot of people will understand anger as I'm portraying it, right? So I could be hungry. I could be hangry, right? I could be sleep deprived. I could be overworked. I could be feeling guilty from something else that happened a few days ago and I haven't processed it yet. So it's all under my anger iceberg, right? And if I can't see underneath the 90% of mass that makes up an iceberg underwater, I can't fix my own issue myself.
And how you take accountability, you help your clients take accountability for themselves. Yeah. Leona, this has been great. This has been great so far. So before we end, I have one last segment. It's called Best for Last. I was going to ask you four questions and you answer within the next 30 seconds.
Okay.
You ready?
Yep.
All right. Question number one, what are you grateful for?
What am I grateful for? The leadership that I've received and the support that I have, my support system.
Okay. Question number two, do you have any regrets?
Zero. I live a life of zero regrets, and I think that's the best way to live.
I definitely agree. And you are very aware of the regrets that you don't have. Question number three, what has been your biggest lesson while being the founder of TBAC Corporate? Am I saying that right? TBAC Corporate.
You said biggest lesson?
Biggest lesson, yep.
Biggest lesson. That I think it reinforced that I know I don't know everything, but I really don't know everything. And that I have to take it back to elementary school sometimes and go back to the basics, because the basics are what help with the stair stepping. And so I think it's knowing when to go back to education versus just pushing through with what I know, if that makes sense.
There's an acronym, KISS, keep it simple, silly.
Mm-hmm. I know keep it simple, stupid. So
I was going to say that one too. And then last question. What does failure is knowledge mean to you?
Lessons. At the end of the day, it's a lesson, right? So failure, to welcome failure is to welcome knowledge in my mind, right? And so I think to welcome a mistake, it's not our favorite thing to do, and we feel frustrated when we make them, but it's, do I have that ability to go above that mistake I just made and be better than it, or am I going to let that take me out? So I would say, yeah, it's a lesson. You just learn from everything.
Wow. Liana, this has been great. Have I been saying your name right this whole time?
Yes, you have.
Okay, just to make sure. Okay. I appreciate it. How can people find you? How can they learn more about you? How can they learn more about TBAC Corporate?
We have an Instagram, a Facebook, a LinkedIn, and a TikTok, which is new for us. I believe it's all at TBAC Corporate. Our TikTok's more fun, actually. We're getting our social media coordinator, Beatrice, she's getting us to do more fun TikToks, and that's actually been reaching more people. So if you guys have TikTok ideas, let me know. But yeah, TikTok, Instagram, and LinkedIn are our big ones.
Liana, thanks again for coming on to the Failure is Knowledge podcast. What was your biggest takeaway from being on the podcast?
That it's nice to talk about some expertise that I know that I have, but I don't get to talk about it. I'm just talking to people about how to help them. So it's nice to kind of reiterate a lot of the things that I've learned. And to, again, like in the last one that we did, just kind of look back at my life and kind of see what shaped me and allow me to get to this beautiful podcast with you here today.
I definitely agree. I appreciate it. And then last question for someone that's hesitant to come on to the Failure is Knowledge podcast, what is one piece of advice that you can give to them?
The Nike motto, just do it. I think that one is such an underrated, everyone knows it, everyone hears it, they even say it, but I feel like people don't understand that if you just do something, if you just try it, no matter if you've never done it before, you open doors of opportunity by walking through them naturally, right? So I think just do it, even if you don't want to.